So I'm coming from Reno, Nevada, right? So, and this is actually the mountains, and the picture was taken about, I don't know, in the middle of July last year. So you have plenty of snow. So in fact, okay, how about I use this? Yes, so, good. So, well, in fact, my house is somewhere here, and it takes me about 20 minutes to the nearest ski resort, okay? So I could go there. Yeah, so I go there like I go to a gym, you know. I drive for 20 minutes, I ski, get tired, you know, and go back home, and I still have the entire day, yeah, to do science, of course, right? Okay. So, all right. So, okay. I do come from the field of atomic physics, okay? And this field has seen quite an explosion over the last 10 years or so. So the community itself has received it has been recognized by 3 Nobel Prizes in physics. And in fact, there are several Nobel Prizes in chemistry which are given for related developments. Okay, so this plot, so again, we have this huge influx of young faculty, postdocs, students in the community, and this plot shows the attendance of APS meetings. So, and this is a meeting of the Division of Atomic Medical and Optical Physics, and actually this plots, I don't have enough data points now, but right now it is well over 1,000 that community. And for example, this academic year in US we had 8 open faculty positions in experimental atomic physics. So the community is growing. And of course. Okay. Point taken. Yeah, but the point still remains that the community is growing. Okay, so and different people are excited about different things. Okay, so I'm going to tell you my part of this. Okay, so and before I get started, let me just show a picture of our group with a couple of visitors. Okay, so, and I would like to thank my collaborators people who have contributed to today's talk are actually not shown here, unfortunately, so they already left by the time this picture has been taken. So the main contributions come from Sergei Parsev and Kyle Deloy. Okay, so I would like to thank them. Okay, when you define things, you make things real, right? Let me define what an atom is, okay? In my simple interpretation, so an atom is a nucleus surrounded by a bunch of electrons, as simple as that, right? Okay, so, and the beauty of it is that it is governed by the Coulomb forces, right? And QED, and QED is very well established, right? So it, and basically this allows for a relatively simple interpretation. And I think this is an important point because, for example, in nuclear physics, you deal with nuclear models, hadron interactions, et cetera, which are, you cannot do very precise precise interpretation of observables, but here you can, okay? And another point which I would like to bring immediately to your attention is that we have this truly unprecedented control over internal and external degrees of freedom, okay? So this number has 16 significant figures, okay? So actually, modern atomic clocks do precision spectroscopy at the 80s decimal class. This is optical transition in strontium atom, okay? So, well, in ion clocks, they actually do 18 significant figures, okay? So, okay, so, and these two things, they allow for both, you know, for very nice fundamental physics, and also they allow for some truly amazing practical applications, and
so
I'm going to talk about
it.
It is defined in terms of hyperfine transition in cesium, yeah.
For this cesium, right?
Right.
If you would need some, I don't know, definitions of research or the precision, I don't know, in alpha, it shuts off much earlier.
Yeah. So, and...
It's because that's the pressure of cesium, right, basically.
Well, in fact, optical clocks, I mean, I'm going to... talk about this. Okay, so optical clocks, they are better than the cesium standard, and this creates a problem, in fact. So people are actually looking for a redefinition of the second in terms of optical clocks now. Yeah, okay. So, all right. So I'm going to talk about two things. So I'm going to talk about searches for new physics, and I will also talk about atomic clocks. Okay. So let's talk about. Let's talk about atomic parity violation. Okay, so, okay, most of you probably have been at the LHC, okay, and here I'm showing this picture just to show the scale of this thing, right? So it's huge, it's enormous, right? So, and I would like to compare this with an atomic physics experiment. So a typical atomic physics lab, so an optical table is probably, you know, four of these tables combined together. Okay, so this is an experiment which fits on an optical table. Okay, so and this is an experiment on parity violation in Carl Wieman's group. So and it has typical attributes of an atomic physics experiment. So there is a cesium beam. Okay, there is a bunch of lasers, electric field, some plates. Okay, there is a microwave oven of some sort, okay? So it is a typical atomic physics experiment. But what we have at our disposal is the ability to listen very carefully, okay? To do the very precise measurements. And at the same time, we also have this enormous flux of atoms. I mean, as I remember talking to one of the experimentalists, they typically use like kilograms of cesium in experiments like that. Okay, so it's enormous statistical signal. Okay, so all right. Okay, so and of course atomic scale is NAV scale, right? But because of this ability to listen, okay, we are able to put constraints on elementary particle physics at the level of TeV. Okay, so and yes, it is comparable to the collider experiment. So it's like a David and Goliath story, isn't it? Right? Okay. Well, not quite, right? Of course, you know, atomic experiments are both unique and at the same time they are complementary to particle colliders. Yeah. Okay. So I don't want to stretch this comparison any further, right? Okay, so let's talk about what is happening in atomic parity violation. So, well, the parity transformation, right? It basically takes all the electrons and flips their positions with respect to the nucleus. And of course, the parity transformation commutes with the atomic Hamiltonian. Okay, so it means that atomic stationary states are eigenstates of parity. Okay, so, and of course, the underlying reason for that is that the electromagnetic interactions conserve parity. But now, if you turn on electroweak interactions, right, so in here I'm showing the Z boson exchange with electrons and up and down quarks in the nucleus, they do not conserve parity. Okay, and basically, I mean, one could exploit this in atomic physics experiments, this violation of the mirror symmetry, okay, and place constraints on parity violating signal, right? So, and the question that we are answering is that is about the strength of electrolytic coupling of quarks and electrons. So this is a basic setup. Now let me go to that experiment. Okay, so cesium, it has, well, it has 55 electrons. Okay, so, and basically, I mean, just imagine that, you know, you have this tightly bound core, okay, and then you have one valence electron outside of it. Okay, so it's like a hydrogen atom. Well, not quite, you will see. High note, but nevertheless, you know, it is a relatively simple system. So the ground state is 6s, and I'm looking at the electric dipole transition to the 7s state, and of course, this matrix element is zero because of the parity conservation, right? Okay, so, and but now if you include the weak interaction, right, the weak interaction leads to an admixture of states of opposite parity. So these states, they become dressed, okay? So, and this opens a very weak transition amplitude, okay? So, I'm sorry?
This is for the valence electron that is outside one.
Right.
So why does this transition have to happen against the nucleus? Why can it not happen against the cloud of electrons?
It does happen. I mean, it is a many body system, right?
So you don't really mean that you are evaluating this experiment against the nucleus?
So this is electronic wave function, but it will be affected. Ah, but it is much, much weaker. So, yeah.
The vector coupling to electrons is proportional to 1 minus 4 sine squared theta.
So that is the only suppression?
No, not the only, because this nucleus is also has more of the gigahertz effect. It's a combination of two things, because gamma 5 is proportional to the momentum.
But if you can probe, if you can be
if you have a way wacky kind of electron-electron interaction.
Well, it's not wacky, right? Like, things can cut off into electrons.
Yeah, no, sure, yeah, sure.
But I mean, what is the how sensitive would you be? Are you at all sensitive?
So electron-electron interaction is suppressed by a factor of 1,000 roughly. Compared to electron nucleus in cesium.
You don't do atomic parity violation for that. There is a Stanford experiment on Murdoch scattering, which is rather bizarre.
In fact, I'll go back to that because our interpretation is more precise than that.
Okay.
Okay, so. And in atomic units, this is 10 to the minus 11, so a regular transition amplitude, right, like which enters the lifetime is one atomic unit, so this is 11 orders of magnitude smaller. Yeah? Okay, you should appreciate this because, again, you know, this is that seam of precision of our ability to listen to atoms, you know, at this very precise level that allows this sort of a measurement. Okay, now if I average the Higgs interaction over quarks, basically the effective Hamiltonian which comes out is this, right? So, well, you are familiar with the letters here, right? So, but basically this is a weak charge, and it turns out that we are sensitive to the neutron distribution. Okay, so the protons, the contribution of protons is suppressed. So, and then you could plug this weak Hamiltonian into the that expression for the parity violating amplitude and basically get an expression like that. So this is that matrix element, transition amplitude, right? So this is some form factor multiplied by the weak charge. So I factored out a weak charge. So the parity violating amplitude is measured, okay? So this form factor needs to be computed, and then what you get out is the weak charge, okay? And then the signature of new physics is a comparison of this inferred weak charge with the prediction of the standard model, okay? So if the inferred weak charge differs from the prediction of the standard model, then we could talk about new physics. If not, then you could put some additional constraints. So at the time when we were doing this work, our interest was spiked by these extra Z bosons, and they are predicted by various they are predicted by various extensions to the standard model, right? And at the LHC, it turns out that this is the cleanest signal that they could get. Okay, so and it turns out that this difference between the inferred and peak charge and the prediction of the standard model could be parameterized in terms of the masses of Z prime. So this is a specific Z prime in SO10. Okay, so but nevertheless, so if we see a deviation, this could indicate that the existence of Z prime. Okay, so. All right, now I am a theorist, right? So, and basically, okay, so this plot here shows the history of this form factor, okay? So the stripe here is a prediction of the standard model for the weak charge combined with the experimental measurement, okay? So this, this area here, it reflects experimental error bar. And this is the story of how that form factor calculations and error bars on the form factor developed over time. And at the time when we started, actually about 10 years ago, the error bar was at the level of 1%. So it ultimately went down to about 0.5%. But still, I mean, we were aiming at a much better theoretical accuracy, okay? So, and I'm not going to open this right now, okay? So you have to wait. I mean, it took me 10 years to understand where that point is going to be. So it's going to take you just 5 minutes, yeah? To see where it is. So just, just bear with me, right? Okay. So basically, okay, so, the error on the weak charge could be computed as a quadrature, right, of experimental error bar and the theoretical error bar. Okay, so and well, at the time we have started, the theoretical error bar was about 3 times larger than the experimental error bar, and the question is how to reduce sigma. And basically, if you dig through all of this corrections through what is happening in those form factor calculations, you basically realize that theoretical uncertainty is limited by inaccuracy of solving the basic correlation atomic structure problem. And of course, right, that problem has been around since the inception of quantum mechanics, right? How come, you know? It's my choice. Yeah, right. So, okay. Why is it so difficult? Wait. Why is it so difficult, right? Okay? So, let's try to understand that.
But in the last slide, you thought that what you're after is you want to get Q, right?
Right, but to get Q, you need form factor. And basically, that is what we are trying to. Experiment has been done, right? So, and we actually need to improve theoretical accuracy, at least at the level of the experimental accuracy, right? To minimize that error. Make sense? Yeah?
Yeah, just the band you drew for the star model, I don't understand that band.
Okay.
Band
I'm going to show that that plot again, right? So, okay. How about I continue? Okay. Otherwise, we are not going to get to the clocks. Yeah. Okay. So.
Well,
okay.
We are
there for me,
so we
huh? Okay. So why is it so difficult, right? So, as I told you, cesium has 55 electrons, right? So if I take, I mean, each electron has 3 coordinates, right? So basically, the wave function would have inside 165 coordinates, right? So suppose I take a very, very poor grid, I mean, a very coarse grid of just 10 points per dimension, right? Which is really, really bad, okay? But nevertheless, suppose I do that, right? So then the number of points in Hilbert space is going to be this number, right? Okay? So is it a large number? So it exceeds the estimated number of atoms in the universe, okay? So even if you are clever enough to do calculations like that, there is no way you can store your wave function and extract your form factor maxim, yeah? Okay? So, let me just show you, I mean, what is required, in fact, for calculations like that. So basically, weak interaction occurs in the nucleus, so then, the electron inside the nucleus is relativistic, so you basically need to start immediately from the Dirac equation, okay? So if you do some sort of a mean field theory like Hartree-Fock and try to compute, for example, hyperfine structure constants, as you all know, it describes interaction of electrons with magnetic moments of the nucleus, right? So you are immediately off by a factor of two. I mean, so your accuracy is so poor, right? So, and then a clever way of approaching this problem is through the many body perturbation theory, okay? And basically, we apply some all-order techniques, and for specialists in the audience, you know, we use some flavor of the couple cluster method. So if you are familiar with that, so. And basically, I mean, it is a very technically challenging task, like storage of wave functions it takes about 100 gigabytes, okay? So it's a big computational problem. So, and of course, you know, all these details are important, right? And let me, in fact, tell you a story, okay? About the importance of technical details. I promised to entertain you, right? So this is a Pauli's letter to Oppenheimer. Okay, so in 1958, Heisenberg came out with his own theory of everything. So, and he was giving interviews on the radio. Okay, and Pauli has heard one of these interviews, and he was. Heisenberg was saying that he has a theory of everything, but a few minor technical details are missing. Okay, so and Pauli was very annoyed with that, right? So and he wrote a letter to Robert Oppenheimer, right? So and I know that this is very difficult to read, so I'll make this easier for you. Okay, so. And the letter says, this is to show the world that I can paint like Titian, okay? And then he draws this empty jagged box, right? So only technical details are missing. So since I don't want you to compare me with Heisenberg, okay, I'm going to talk about technical details a little bit, yeah? Okay, so this is, in fact, how the parity violating amplitude looks like, okay? So remember, it was a dipole amplitude, right? So this is a dipole matrix element. This is the matrix element of the weak interaction. And I have a summation of intermediate states over intermediate states. So it is a pseudoscalar. So intermediate states have the same J, but opposite parity, okay? And these are, of course, energies. So it is, I mean, a usual perturbative expression, right? So, and the weak Hamiltonian looks like that. And so it occurs in the nucleus. The dipole matrix elements are usually accumulated far away from the nucleus, right? Okay, so what is happening is that you basically need to know the wave function very well at the nucleus and far away from the nucleus, okay?
Which is,
yeah. No, it is ab initio theory. So we start with, I think the only parameter that we use is a fine structure constant.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right. So, okay, so, and of course, the accuracy is important. That is why we are doing this, right? So, okay, so, and then how do you prove, in fact, that you've done something well? Okay, so this is a certain combination of hyperfine structure constants which mimic the weak interaction. Of course, I mean, you cannot compare with the weak interaction because we, I mean, it's the matrix elements of the weak interaction because, I mean, we are after them, right? So, and this particular combination actually mimics matrix elements of the weak interaction very well. So what this shows, okay, so this is a deviation from experimental values, okay, so I take experimental parameters, and basically this line here represents experimental values for different matrix elements, okay? So the error bar on the experiments on the hyperfine structure constants is virtually zero on this scale, okay? So, and these dots are our values.
What are the theoretical error bars?
That is what I'm trying to determine, right? Basically, what it shows that the theoretical error bars are at the level of 0.2%. I mean, there are some other tests that we do, okay, so... Yeah, I mean, it is a many-body theory, right? I mean, there is some self-consistency, but we cannot solve it exactly. So I have to compare with something, right? Okay, so we also compare with energy levels, right? And the next... A view graph is a comparison of the dipole matrix elements. So those dipole matrix elements, they are usually taken like from lifetimes, from some ultra-cold collision studies, from Feshbach resonances. So these type of things. And basically, again, we agree with experimental data, but now experimental data has error bars, right?
This is what people call star
amplitude. No, this transition amplitude. So. For example, the lifetime of the 6p 1/2 state, it decays to the ground state, you could measure the lifetime and deduce the dipole matrix element. I mean, there are some other ways of doing this. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is, in fact, is that we can claim an accuracy of about 0.2%. Okay, so basically, now it's time to actually reveal, yeah? Okay? Drum roll, please, yeah? So. Okay. Okay, so if you are doing this for about 10 years, you would like to see a point somewhere here, right? And in fact, we use some sort of a blind test, I mean, theoretical, just to be sure that, you know, that we are not, you know, convincing ourselves, you know, of, I mean.
Did you introduce an offset in calculation?
Well, we did not add we didn't divide through by the experimental number for a long time. I mean, at the time when he needed to do this. Well, this is not like an EDM measurement because it is a single point, right? So, but nevertheless, you know, so. In fact, Sergei has divided initially incorrectly, and the point was somewhere here, yeah? So, it happens, yeah? So, anyways, but we do agree with the prediction of the standard model. Okay, let's talk about some implications, right? At this point, in fact, I mean, this is for the first time in the history of atomic parity violations that the experimental, that the theoretical error bar is in fact better than the experimental error bar. So experimentalists have to come up with better experiments. Okay. So, all right, now we agree with the weak charge, with the prediction of the standard model. Now, in terms of Z primes, we have raised the limit on the mass of Z primes by about a factor of 2 compared to the direct search at the Tevatron. And at the LHC, actually, they recently raised that limit to about 2 keV, so they have done a better job, I guess, but nevertheless, I mean, for a while that was the best limit, okay? So, and LHC discovery reach is going to be about 5 TeV at full luminosity, so this will be increasingly difficult for atomic parity violation to compete with, definitely, yeah. Okay. So another thing which I wanted to show you is this view graph. So this is running of electrolytic coupling constant, right? So this is Weinberg angle as a function of Q. Okay, and basically there are very precise measurements at the Z pole, right? And the previous measurement, the previous interpretation of parity violation in cesium is basically it was consistent with no running. I mean, this if you look at this blue error bar, which was dominated by Siri, okay, so it was consistent with no running if you think about it. And our point is this green point, so it shifted. It agrees with the standard model, but now definitely, I mean, you could say that that there is a running, yeah, okay. So and basically, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, electrolytic running has been confirmed over energy scale of 4 orders of magnitude, yeah. So and this is and also. Let me show you this view graph here. So this is a collection of various experiments. Okay, so this is that slug. Okay, so the Mueller scattering, right? So and this yellow points, these are future experiments. So you could disregard this at the moment, okay? So, the usual.
I should say that this is a theorist shifting the new depth value right on the curve, right? I mean, this is not really.
But wasn't it shifting quite a lot, right? So, well, that is a snapshot of what has been in the field, I think, a year ago, okay? So, I have not updated this, but nevertheless.
Yeah, but what I meant is this is not how the results from new depth.
Mm-hmm. Right. So my claim, though, is that this point here is actually the most precise measurement below Z pole. Okay.
Well, it's comparable to the slide.
But it's better still. So I was talking to Maxim quite a lot about these dark forces, and basically we could, I mean, since we cannot compete with LHC, right, the logic is that we could probably probe these weakly coupled light particles, and basically, I mean, what one needs to do is basically add a term to the electrolytic coupling, right, and place constraints, I mean, because we have error bars, right, we could place constraints on the couplings and on the masses. A non-trivial thing would happen, in fact, when the range of the interaction is comparable to like to the radius of the atomic cloud. Okay, because I mean, then you really would get some non-trivial atomic physics effects. So that would happen at a few MeV, for a carrier of a few MeV. Yeah. Okay, so let me summarize this part of the talk. Okay, so all right. So basically, what we find a perfect agreement with the standard model. Yeah. So we raised the limit on masses of Z primes. Okay, at least. Yes. I'm afraid of such questions. Exactly. Yes. Right, here we So there is a correction due to neutron skin. Yeah, it is a neutron distribution.
That doesn't occur in traction.
John, it's a vector current with respect to quarks, so it's very little uncertainty. If you go to the other channel, the guy spin on the nucleus and the vector current on electrons, then there is a 100% hadronic uncertainty on that, right? But on the vector current, there is always none.
So, you know the proton distributions very well, right? And basically, people refer to the difference between the neutron and proton distribution as a neutron skin. Okay? Neutron skin. And it is a correction. And in fact, I had a paper on this, so the correction is about 0.2%, and it is included, in fact, in this number that we have for the Pretty Valenti amplitude, the correction is included, it is at the level of 0.2%.
So you know the QCD is
2.2%? No, that is, no.
The QCD doesn't do here much, it's what he's saying is that if you really want to do super precise calculation, you need to know the distribution of different constituents inside the nucleus, including the neutrons, which you can't really measure with the charge radius measurements. So, but that's entering at 0.2%.
Right. So, there were some experiments with antiprotonic atoms. And basically, they had some sort of a fitting formula for the neutron skin. Okay, so I mean, how the radii of two distributions differ. And this 0.2% is some uncertainty. It's a large uncertainty. It comes from their formula.
No systematic
error. Well, I mean.
You're getting a very accurate result.
Right, but that is the main part of that result is atomic correlations, right? And 0.2%, say if I even put here 50%, okay, so, well, 99.8% comes from atomic structure, right? All right, so 99.8% of the total value comes from atomic structure. This is a small correction. So even if I have like 50% error bar on this, it would not affect the overall error bar. Do you understand? Yeah? Okay.
So, Maximo, were you saying that as soon as you start probing the spin distributions, there's
the same experiment also measures what's called the anapole. Spin dependent part of the parity evaluation. And that is, you cannot make a precision science out of this order one because you can't really calculate it. Here it's basically like a charge, right? It's a vector current at low Q squared, atomic Q squared. And that's why it's all this QCD loops.
Okay, so, and of course, I mean, when you develop codes like this, you have to think about other applications, okay? And one of the things that we have done, we got involved into this atomic clock community, and I would like to spend some time, the second part of my talk, talking about clocks, okay? So, well, I mean, you know how the clocks work, right? You need a periodic motion, right? You need a periodic motion. You can count the number of oscillations, 1, 2, 3, and multiplied by the period, and this tells time. Okay? As easy as that, right? So, well, what happens in atomic clock, okay, so you basically just use the Bohr principle, right? So, okay, you know the positions of energies, and you divide it by the Planck constant, you get a new clock. And what, in fact, happens, I mean, people have, say, I could probably go in a little bit more detail. So they have two level system, right? So this is your new clock, the frequency of the clock, and then they have external laser, for example, laser cavity, and it is a tunable. So new is tunable at the source. So you basically tune this frequency to be equal to the clock frequency. And then you count the number of oscillations. 1, 2, 3, and if you know the frequency, you got time. Okay? This is the principle of operation of atomic clocks. Yeah. So, well, timekeeping, of course, it is a long, long history, right? So for example, Chinese water clocks, they are losing about 1,000 seconds a day, right? So then a modern wristwatch like this, for example, it loses about 1 second over a week, okay? So it's not bad, right? I mean, I could be late by a second. It's all right, yeah? So, and atomic clocks, they lose about a femtosecond a day, okay? So the clocks I'm going to talk about today, in fact, they lose a fraction of a second over the age of the universe. Okay? So, just imagine, you know, somebody were to build, some poor soul were to build this clock at the Big Bang, right? And this clock were to survive until today for some reason, right? So, and that clock would be off by less than a second, yeah? Okay? Imagine that, okay? So, and just a moment. And of course, you know, there are some applications. I mean, why do we need these clocks? For example, this is a GPS system, right? So all of us use GPS nowadays. So in fact, a fun fact about this is that each satellite, it has 6 atomic clocks on board, okay? So they are not as precise as the clocks I'm going to talk about today, but nevertheless, they do operate using atomic clocks, and basically they use the method of triangulation, right? They basically just measure time delays of various signals, yeah?
Don't they use a different, rubidium rather than cesium?
They use rubidium. Rubidium is more stable, yeah? Mm-hmm. But it's still atomic clock. It is still an atomic clock, yeah? Okay, so it turns out that, so precision timing is, of course, very important in digital networks, okay? So if you have multiple packets flying around, each packet is labeled with a timestamp, okay? And then you have to assemble them. I mean, have you ever thought, what is the reason why people could talk on cell phones at the same time, right? The carrier bandwidth is actually very narrow. I mean, it's very expensive, right? So, but they do this multiplexing, and they do this multiplexing with the help of GPS, in fact. But previously, atomic clocks actually were housed right at the cell phone towers. So, the modern cell towers, they use just the GPS signal, which has been improved quite dramatically, right? So, and then we also have some fundamental physics questions that we could address with atomic clocks. So the unit of time, the second, okay, is defined in terms of the cesium clock, okay? So then, this is some hyperfine transition, and in fact, this number is defined exactly, okay, because it defines the second. And since the speed of light is actually also is defined exactly, the unit of time defines the unit of length. Okay? So and this is in fact the official US clock. Okay, so this is a fountain clock in cesium. At NIST in Boulder, Colorado. Okay, so it works in the following way. So you have this cloud of ultra cold atoms. Okay, so, and by the way, I mean, one of people who worked on this clock was Stephen Chu. Yeah, and Stephen Chu is the secretary of Department of Energy, right? So, I mean, so, and so this is a bunch of ultra cold atoms, okay? So, and this cloud basically is launched up, right? So, it's launched up, it flies about a meter, okay? And it comes back. And on the way up and down, it is interrogated. So this is a microwave cavity which interrogates it, right? So, and one of the questions that we ask, you know, can we make this clock smaller? Okay? So, and in fact, what I'm going to show you is how to shrink these clocks by about a factor of 1,000. Not 1,000, 1,000,000, yeah? Active area of these clocks, right? So why these clocks are so large, right? Remember, well, I was talking about interrogation time, right? So the frequency resolution, which is important for resolving that clock transition, is inversely proportional to the interrogation time. So if you make interrogation time longer, your frequency resolution improves. Okay, undergraduate physics, right? So now, well, let's trap atoms, yeah? How about that? Then we could look at them forever, right? We could improve interrogation time indefinitely. Cool, but then, I mean, one of the methods of trapping atoms are these optical lattices, okay? And basically what is happening in optical lattices, okay, my laser doesn't work, okay? So, but nevertheless, let's try. No. So you basically take a laser, you shine it on a mirror, you retro-reflect it, you get a standing wave. Okay? So this is the standing wave of laser light. And the potential that atoms see is described by the square of the local field, okay, multiplied by the dynamic parallelizability. So this is AC Stark shift, okay? So, but then if you think about it, I mean, this thing is going to shift your clock levels, okay? So, I mean, you get into trouble immediately, you know, I mean, laser is a very powerful thing, right? If I shine it into your eye, right, you will feel it, okay? So the same way if I shine, I don't want to do that, okay? So, but nevertheless, so if I shine a laser on an atom, the clock levels will get perturbed, okay? So, okay, so you can trap it, but of course, I mean, you will be trapping something which is not very useful, okay?
Well, I think the real problem is that, presumably you can account for the laser for the rest levels, but the real problem is the laser is not constant in power.
Yeah, yeah. And also, these atoms would travel, in fact, inside of this field, right? So, and probe different intensities, even if you keep the intensities the same, right? And okay, but the beauty of it is that, you know, that typically the typical optical lattice experiment, I mean, the active region is about 10 micrometer long. So instead of a meter, you get 10 micrometers, right? Which is great, right? So, but how do we solve this problem, right? So, in fact, this is how the clock is perturbed, okay? So this is a shift of the clock level due to that interaction with the laser field. Now, I have explicitly written out the ground state parallelizability and the excited state parallelizability. Okay, and this is a differential shift because I have two clock levels, right? They shift, okay? And the point is that, and that was really brilliant idea by Hidetoshi Katori, that if you tune, okay, so these guys, the dynamic parallelizability, they depend on frequency of the laser light. Okay? And you could tune frequencies very precisely. And in fact, you could find the point, so-called magic frequency, where these two permissibilities are the same. Okay? And this is really, really simple but very powerful idea. Okay? So then this guy is just zero. So you can trap your atoms, right? And have zero perturbation on your clock transition. So this shows, in fact, this position of the magic wavelength of the laser light for ytterbium atom. In fact, I mean, we have
gradients of the electric field are also not small, right? And so are there shifts associated with gradients? Because if this is the field by the laser, right? I mean, it's still.
So there are some gradients, yeah, but they are actually at the level of 10 to the minus 19 or so. So they are negligible. So people, of course, know about this. Okay. So and this is this plot comes from our paper where we proposed ytterbium clock, in fact. So you know, I mean, as a series, you know, it's really good to see, you know, that something that you have proposed works. Okay. So, and in fact, this clock has been built at NIST, you know, and every time I go into that lab where this clock, you know, ticks away, okay, my heart melts, you know. It's so good, you know. So, and in fact, this magic wavelength, so here you see it is the permissibility of the upper clock state, and this is the permissibility of the ground clock state. They intersect, and this is the magic point. This is the point where this is equal to Z, and it vanishes, yeah? Okay? So, but then the next question we are asking, we also propose the Mercury clock, and in fact, the Mercury clock has this fractional accuracy of about 10 to the minus 18, and the Mercury clock is operational in Paris, in Tokyo, and it is being built in Germany as well now. Okay, so, but what about the primary cesium standard? It turns out, so I'm running out of time, okay? You guys had plenty of questions, so I have to skip some of this, but it turns out that it is possible to build clocks like that, okay? And basically, I mean, I'm proud of this name of the micromagic clock because they operate in the microwave domain, and also they have a micrometer size of an active region, yeah? So that's why they're called micromagic clocks. Okay, so there is some theory, some magic wavelengths. Okay, so and just let me do so we have written this colloquium paper, so it is written at the graduate student level. So if you guys are interested in this, you could learn more from this colloquium paper. Okay, so and what the other thing is that this nuclear clock. Okay, so far I was talking about accuracy at the 10 to the minus 18 level. Okay, and this is a projected accuracy of modern clocks. Okay, so the question is how to go to the next level. Okay, so in one of and probably at the moment this is the only system which advertises 10 to the minus 19, so it is the next level. So there are two keywords here. It is a nuclear clock, okay? Instead of atomic clock, it is a nuclear clock, and that accuracy, okay? So and if you think about nucleus, right? I mean, nucleus has a size which is 10,000 times smaller than an atom. Yep. Okay, so, and of course, I mean, if the size of the system is reduced, okay, all the couplings to external perturbations are reduced too. So, it's great to have a nucleus as the quantum oscillator. Okay? But then, of course, there is a problem, right? I mean, because typically in the nucleus, all the energy scales are at the MeV level and there are no lasers. But it turns out that thorium-209, it has this unique level structure which has a laser-accessible transition. 229, okay. 220. Because I'm writing a paper about bismuth 209. That's why I, yeah. So thorium 229, okay. So, and this transition, it has not been seen yet, okay. People are searching for it, okay. But let me show you just the projected accuracy budget of a clock. So it is a proposal, okay. So, and essentially, okay, what limits these clocks, okay, is a gravitational shift, okay? So, if I were to build two clocks like that, okay, so they are sitting next to each other in the lab, and they are off by a millimeter, okay, a technical thing, right? They are off, so they are sitting in the Earth's gravitational field, and they are off by a millimeter. So, that would affect accuracy at that level, okay? Just the gravitational shift, okay?
So, so why not just instead of measuring using the clock, use it to measure G?
Well, I mean, there are some people have thought about this, but actually, there are specialized gravitometers that could do a better job. Okay, yeah. Because, I mean, here the integration time is going to be weeks.
I mean, if this is a small, those gravitometers are usually pretty large. If this is really a very small system,
okay, all right. So, and, okay. So, the funny thing, you know, when you read comments about what you've done on the net, okay, I'm going to read the comment. You've managed to find the single most depressing scientific endeavor of all time. Spend years of research trying to make an ultra-precise clock more precise. If they succeed, only electrons will notice. And then it comes. What's the suicide rate about these people? I could attest zero, but okay. Nevertheless, I mean, why do we care, right? Why do we care? So one of the things is that, for example, one could build deep space navigation system, right? So, for example, if you were to use a GPS on Mars, okay, and the satellites would be orbiting the Earth, you would need a much better accuracy in time resolution, and this would help there. Okay, then people do experiments testing if the constants of nature drift in time. Okay, for example, if you had two clocks today, right, and they are different clocks, their frequency depends on, for example, on the fine structure constant in different ways. Okay, I do the measurement today and say a year from now, and then do the frequency comparison again. Okay, and I could see, in fact, if that ratio has drifted or not. Okay, so this places limits on the drift of fundamental constants. And then I'm not going to talk about this today, but these clocks also, they are actually elements of the perfect quantum memory. And in fact, we had a couple of quantum computing proposals just based on this clock. Okay, so. Okay, so maybe let me emphasize one of the things, right? So this new generation of atomic clocks, it is in fact a device in search of an application, okay? So, and we talked to Maxim here about some of the potential things that one could probe with clocks, okay, at this level of accuracy, but it would be wonderful, in fact, to find maybe even better, I mean, some additional tests of of the foundations of physics or fundamental physics in general with these clocks. Okay, so it is very precise device, right? I mean, it's essentially this is probably the most accurate device ever built. Okay, so and the question is how to use it to learn something new about nature. Yeah. Okay. So and finally, I will finish, you know, by telling you a story. Okay. So I was the other day I was flying. I mean, I'm a theorist, right? And atomic clock. This is experimentalist domain, right? So the question, a natural question is, you know, why a theorist would care, you know, or experimentalist would care about a theorist working on this thing. So, and okay, the other day, you know, I was flying on a plane. Okay, so and I have these catalogs, right? Yeah. So each advertise different things, right? So the things you really don't need, but nevertheless, they are there. And there was an advertisement for a wristwatch, a very beautiful wristwatch. And there was an article, you know, and it says that this Swiss, they were comparing this, building this very beautiful timepieces, wristwatches, to, you know, to like building a skyscraper out of matchsticks. Okay, so something very intricate, right? So if you think about it, by that comparison, the experimentalists working on these atomic clocks, they are performing miracles, right? Okay, so and okay, so this experimentalist can walk on water, right? Okay, but I am the person who actually tells them where the stepping stones are. All right, so. Okay, so that is the role of the theory in this experimental business. Okay, so, okay, so, and on this note, let me just stop, yeah, and we could take more questions if you want.
Thank you very much.
I'm time for a stupid question too, a facetious one. Can you tell me anything about the mass of the Higgs boson?
There are these precision data feeds, right? People like Paul Langacker, right, and others. They do these feeds, and in fact, well, our point, in fact, participates on equal rights with whatever data they have. Yeah, so it is all blended in. So
in your formula of H, rho sub n g sub n times h sub q.
Yeah.
If you rewrite g sub n as g squared over mass of the w squared.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You can invert the thing.
Yeah.
Mw.
Yeah.
What do you get?
Well, Mw is known very well, right? So, I mean, this is not a fair question.
Mw is known to three decimal places.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what? The Fermi constant is known to what? To five or six
five,
significant
five
figures. Yeah. Here you go. But in terms of Higgs, actually, I don't think that atomic parity violation actually adds much weight to the existing precision data there. So it's, I mean, it is in the blend, but I don't think it affects the bounds that much.
If you know the W mass and the Z mass, you can determine the Higgs mass times the first group.
I think Marciana has done some, or Rosner maybe has done calculations like that. I saw some papers, yeah, a while ago, in fact, yeah. So, yeah.
Very good. Any further questions?